history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown is, perhaps, as we're going to hear today, you don't really even have a hometown, so to speak. No matter where you are, there are some stories out there that the rest of us need to hear. We'll never hear them unless we take the time to ask a few questions, to listen what comes back our way. And the idea is to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made, to preserve their stories so we never forget that price has been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, boy, how much we learn. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I'm pretty sure that's going to be the case today with 94-year-old Chuck Ferriter of Claremont, California. Pretty amazing that this guy is alive. And I guess, Chuck, I can call you a walking miracle because it seems like a miracle that you're walking.
That's the truth.
And we're going to get to why that's the case. But
I won't deny it.
Take me back to Custer County, Nebraska, as a boy. How'd your family end up in those parts?
Well, they were Irish immigrants, and they landed in Boston, and trying to find food, they started west, and Grandpa saw a brochure and free land in the sand hills of Nebraska. Didn't have a clue what a sandhill looked like, or he was just an Irish fisherman, but he kept moving and finally filed a claim. They put all of their stuff and all the kids in a railroad car and headed west, and that train dropped their car. They had a whole car. When they got to Wood River, Nebraska, the conductor, they didn't announce it at all. They just stopped and started unhooking the car. They had taken a Studebaker wagon apart, and it was part of their cargo. So they had to figure out how to put that wagon back together. It had come disassembled, but they managed to get it together, and then they put everything in it and went shopping for a team of horses. The guy that they were talking to about the horses, he was a knowledgeable old guy. It was a business that he had set up. He met people at the train, and he helped them buy their horses, and he suggested that they use a three-hitch team. They managed to get out of town without running over anything, and once they got out on the trail, and it was all it was a trail, there were no roads anywhere, he suggested that they buy enough lumber to shore a well, 20-foot deep well, so they had that material there. And they said, you better buy a window, at least one window and a door for the house you got to build. And they did that, and all this stuff is going into the Studebaker wagon. The guy that they bought the horses from gave Grandma a female dog. He said, you're going to need somebody to talk to, and this little lady will talk to you if you just listen good. And it turned out to be the case.
And you have a photograph here from 1888 that shows your ancestors on that plot of land. And there's some beautiful-looking horses in that photo. And is it true that they had to catch all those wild horses?
Yeah. One of my aunts, Aunt Jenny, learned how to catch them from Indian folks that came by. The Pawnee that had been moved to Oklahoma, they walked home again, just little pods of them. And they always were hiding from the pony soldiers because they'd walk them back if they caught them.
And you heard all these stories growing up from your grandparents or what?
Yeah.
The land we're talking about that your family had homesteaded in the 1800s is where you were born, out
yeah.
on the ranch.
Yeah, I was born right there. Originally, when they got there, being instructed by the old guy that took them there, he called himself a land locator. And that's exactly what he was, land that was available for homesteading. Just their getting out of town without an accident was a miracle. They traveled that whole day toward the northwest. At sundown, all of the kids and a calf, they bought a cow. And of course, she came with a calf because they wanted her for milk. The calf and all the kids were up on top of this lumber and all the other stuff they had loaded into the wagon. When they managed to get down off of it, Grandpa had to help them. Getting down was no small thing. They were delighted to play in the meadow that they were in. They just thought, this is the greatest. And they spent the night under the wagon, sleeping. And then next day, on to bigger and greater things toward the northwest. And eventually, they got to their valley. They pulled their teams, pulled this wagon up over a crest of a hill, and the old land locator said, "This is it," pointed out toward a nice flat valley, and he said, "This is home." And World War I came along. I was born in 24.
Right, and after World War I?
Yeah, but a lot of guys came home badly hurt and dying as they walked. I remember all of that. We were just told to never mind. They'll probably die. And of course they did. I remember there was one old guy, a cowboy named Mr. Lewis. And I used to try to sidle my pony over alongside him so I could talk to him. But he wouldn't talk. He'd cough. Of course, their lungs were gone. The gas in World War
I. Oh, sure, yeah.
He'd cough and spit downwind and then touch a spur to his pony and get away from the question. And I never got a chance to talk to him. Never learned his story. My dad and his brothers and his father built the school. It was a little square white building. It was probably 20 by 30. And that's where everybody went to school. All the kids off of all the ranches all around, they all came there and went to school. It was District 222.
And I'm just guessing that everybody from the youngsters to the high schoolers are all in that same building together?
Oh, yeah. There were benches, and there were different classes, and the class was held over in the corner. When your class wasn't in order, you were in your bench or chair working. So it just, everybody worked all the time.
Well, I know your family had six kids in the school, but how many children total in this country school?
Every year was different. By the time I got to high school, there were 34 people in my class.
That's a pretty big class.
But out in that country school, District 222, I doubt if there were ever 20 kids altogether.
So you grow up, you've got an older brother, a younger brother, you've got three sisters. When you're out there on all that wide open space, what are those dreams that are floating through your head that you're saying, hey, someday when I'm bigger, when I'm grown up, I'm going to do this and this and this and this?
Very little of that.
Yeah? Didn't have time?
Didn't have time. Dealing with what every day. I don't recall sitting around dreaming at all. No, we were just too busy.
And when your brother, your older brother John, decided to join the Marine Corps in 1938, was that a big deal?
It was a big deal. And he had no idea what he was getting into. It so happened that the boys all slept in a room upstairs in the house that they built, replacing the dugout and those shelters. There were three of us, three brothers. My older brother entertained us every night, told us a story. And it was an ongoing, never-ending story about his experiences in the Army. He didn't know about the Marine Corps at that time, so he was in the Army.
In his imagination, he was in the Army.
All just imagination.
Uh-huh.
Well, of course, he read it in dime novels.
Sure.
That's where he got his ideas. I remember my younger brother, we're playing out in the yard, and he said, "I don't know how we're going to get out of that problem with Sergeant," whatever his name, Sergeant Brown. And I, for a minute, didn't know who the hell Sergeant Brown was, but but then I remembered, oh, he was in the story last night. This little guy was worried about it. He thought it was real.
The stories must have been pretty real to him.
Yeah.
Well, and then in a few years, the stories would be real.
Yeah.
Do you remember December 7th, 1941?
Yeah, sure do. It was a beautiful sunny day. We didn't know where Pearl Harbor was, but we did know where Hawaii was. There was a globe in our school, and all of us studied that globe. That morning, my dad had gotten up early, and he was doing his chores. And when he came in, he said, "The damn Japs have bombed Pearl Harbor." And all of us said, "Where's Pearl Harbor?" Thought it might be over the next hill. He said, "No, it's on Hawaii." Of course, then we knew where Hawaii was. And that was about the end of it, really. By that time, my brother had already joined the Marine Corps, so we wondered if he was okay. And it turned out that he was on liberty in L.A. when it happened. And people in their cars, picked the servicemen up and took them to their base.
And your brother ended up serving throughout World War II and even the Korean War in the Marines?
Yeah.
And when did Chuck decide, you know, I'm going to have to be part of this worldwide conflict myself?
Well, it came kind of in stages. In high school, I took a test that was for what they called the Navy V-12 program. I'm think that was the name of it.
Yeah, you go to college instead of going overseas.
For 2 years. Uh-huh. You go to college 2 years, and they teach you to fly an airplane. And anyway, I passed the test, and so I had that in my back pocket, kind of waiting for the draft board to make it necessary to go, because everything depended on that. The folks wouldn't let me go until I was being drafted. I mean, they needed everybody.
Yeah, they've got a lot of land, a lot of animals, a lot of stuff to take care of.
Yeah, but the letters from the draft board began to get very serious, so I went to Omaha to join the Navy V-12 program. Got down there, and it turned out that by that time, the program was still there, but they didn't really take it serious anymore. They already had all their pilots that they needed, so they found that I had a heart murmur. I didn't know what the hell that was, so it didn't bother me at all, but I knew I was in and out of the program before I knew what happened. Going back to the bus station to get a bus home, when I walked into the station, there was a sign there, taller than I was, that said, "Join the Merchant Marine," and there was a phone number. And I thought, I wonder what it'll cost to call. But it must have been a toll-free number because the guy answered right away. And the guy that answered said, "Where are you?" I guess the calls came from everywhere.
Sure.
I said, "I'm in Omaha, Nebraska." He says, "Are you a cowboy?" And I didn't know whether to say yes or no. I didn't know whether it'd be good or bad. But I took a chance, and I said, "Yeah, I'm a cowboy." He said, "Good. Cowboys make good sailors. They learn to take care of their horse, and that helps them to understand they got to take care of their ship."
Huh.
I said, I'm down here to join the Navy V-12 program, and they told me I got a heart murmur. He says, "Oh, pay no attention to that. Those guys have never been to sea. They don't know what the hell's going on." Because they hadn't been to sea, they didn't know nothing in his mind.
Right.
Anyway, he said, "You got to either go to Catalina Island in California or Sheepshead Bay in New York." And he said, "I think Sheepshead Bay is easiest for you." So I got on a train. The guy on the phone had told me, he said, "Oh, just get off the train at Penn Station. Any cab driver will bring you out to where we are, Sheepshead Bay." So that's what happened. I got in a cab, and he took me right to Sheepshead Bay. And they immediately started making a sailor out of a cowboy.
How was that transition for you?
It was easy. I loved the whole thing.
And what kind of ship did they put you on?
Well, getting on a ship was something else. Actually, you know, at that time, those ships leaving New York were being sunk before they got out of sight.
All the U-boats in the Atlantic?
Yeah. But they put me back on a train to go to the Aleutian Islands. And I got on a ship at Seattle and went to Dutch Harbor. And at Dutch Harbor, I got on the ship I was assigned to, which is, they call it an FS freighter, just small freighter, and went on out to Attu and Kiska out in the Aleutians. I was out there for all winter. There's two ratings, ordinary seaman and able seaman. When you go aboard, you're ordinary, and then you get to be able. What the ship did was take toilet paper and ammunition and everything that all of the troops needed.
Mm-hmm.
We took them from Dutch Harbor out to where they were needed. Then that was over when the Japanese bugged out one day. They were living above the cloud line. That the Aleutian Islands is just a god-awful place. They're little green hills that poke their top of them up into the cloud fog. And the Japanese got in there and got up above the clouds, and they were shooting down at the GIs down, terrible casualties, and they were scot-free up there. You couldn't see them. But one day they left. That changed everything, and we left.
No troops that needed to be supplied anymore, no, so you guys went elsewhere. So where'd you go from there?
To the big ships. Went back to Seattle and got on a hospital ship. But I liked the bigger ships once I got onto them.
It's time for our first break, but there is much more to come from Chuck Ferriter of Claremont, California. He served in the Merchant Marines during World War II and the Korean War when he ended up suffering a catastrophic injury. If you'd like to order his book, In the Gentle Blue Light of the Dog Star, it's linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.